This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Hello, my name is Mark Hayes and welcome to the Keynes Seminar at Robinson College, Cambridge. On the 1st of March 2011, our first speaker was Dr. Jerry Corvisanos, Professor of Innovation and Entrepreneurship in the Centre for Regional Innovation and Competitiveness at the University of Ballarat in Victoria, Australia. He discussed investment and innovation policy in the context of sustainable development with a response from Dr. Jan Toporowski, Head of Economics at SOAS in London. You can download slides to accompany the talk from the PKSG website. Enjoy listening.
Right. Well, thank you for all of you coming, particularly the students. And thanks, Mark, for organising the seminar. Can I say, from an Australian Antipodean perspective, that it's lovely to get your emails all the time that enables us to... In fact, I might sit down. We might make it just a bit more less formal. So it's very nice from an Antipodean sort of perspective to have all this and to be in contact with what's more of the heart of post-Keynesian and heterodox ideas around England. The frustrating thing is, of course, we can very rarely come to these things, but it's very good of you to keep emailing and doing. Jan, thank you for taking the opportunity to come and be my discussant. I haven't seen Jan since Poland, Warsaw, the centenary conference on Kaletsky that we both presented papers at. So, and Mark I haven't seen for many years since post-Kansas City. So. All right, so what I'd like to do with this, just to tell you that this is, I really need feedback, so I'm particularly thankful to Jan for this. It is a work in progress. This is, I suppose, the essence of the book that I promised Edward Elgar for many years, even before the GFC, and I'm sort of saying to him that the GFC distracted me, but that's just an excuse, and still I'm working on it. Anyway, I'm starting with a quote from a Cambridge scholar. The quote is from somebody a lot further back than Keynes. It goes back to 1620 by Francis Bacon. I'm told, and we'll see a statue of him, I'm told there is a statue in Cambridge somewhere. I've got to find it. The quote, in a way, encapsulates what my story is going to be about. And the essence of the quote is about human knowledge, which is the essence of innovation, and human power, which is about power relationships. And I'm looking at cause and effect. And what's interesting about this is that Francis Bacon recognised the power of science to command, but must be obeyed. He was fighting against the Flat Earth Society, of that, no, you cannot question nature, because if you sail too far, you'll just fall off the side. He was questioning that. The inductive method... He was saying, well, you know, you try sailing, experiment and find out if you're going to fall off. He was quite critical. And he was the first one to talk about and actually fashion a national innovation system based around science and technology and building a whole layers of knowledge base and create a different type of society. But he also recognised that nature must be obeyed, even though you can, to some of you, there were wrong interpretations of Bacon as to saying that you can go completely the other way, ignore nature completely. No, there's modern study on Bacon says that you cannot do that. So you've got to work within that, within the rules that basically operate through nature. So we'll come back to Bacon right at the end. The Kaletskian approach that I'm taking is a political economy perspective, straight out. I've used Kurt Rothschild, who recently died, unfortunately, a paper in which he identified Kaletskian, particularly his political aspects of full employment, as a classic example of political economy. Well, I've mailed my flag to the mast very clearly because recently I wrote a paper called Political Aspects of Innovation and used very much the concept of the structure of the Political Aspects of Full Employment paper to tell the story about innovation policy, whereas Kalitsky was talking about full employment policy. So you can see where I'm coming at. Here I'm talking about the interplay of economics, sociology, politics, the role of power and influence. All is endogenized. There's nothing exogenous about it. It's all interplaying within the system. But political economy goes back to Adam Smith. Adam Smith was not talking about just simply supply and demand. He talked about all the relationships from production to buying and selling to the laws, customs and government and distribution. So, and it's all linked to technological progress because he was facing the biggest change in innovation at that time. And it wasn't through significant new technology. It was through simply a change in the process, through specialization, which was more an organizational. Industrial Revolution started from an organizational perspective rather than a technology. Technology followed, opened up the doors, but wasn't the start. My talk is in the context of institutions of power and the conduct of innovation and its implementation through investment, because for innovation to actually become commercialized and successful, it's got to be financed, it's got to be put into a form of capital stock accumulation. It's actually got to be invested in, as well as investing in people who have got to have the knowledge to operate the equipment and so on. And as my previous book, my book talks about, the investment cycles drive, the investment drives the cycles and the crisis. So I'm going one step deeper back into the innovation story. All right, so I'm taking a critical realist perspective because I see empirical data as being the beginning of the story. I reject atomistic individual perspective, but I see the social world as a system of social structures and agents, and therefore not a closed system of atoms. Causation is not found in event regularity in this critical realist complexity story. It's more about underlying cause mechanisms that you've got to uncover, which the empirics help you see what tendencies are there, but need to go deeper into it. And this is out of a book on critical realism. The whole idea is that, yes, you got a linear thing, structure, mechanism, effect, but you can have other factors which can have a disturbance on the effect and the event. And they could be stochastic and exogenous. But in my world, those other conditions are part of the endogenous system. So when you see the stars in the sky, you say there are stars. During the day, there is no stars. So therefore, the stars do not exist. No. It's part of an endogenous system. It just happens to be that there is a stronger light of sun coming in as a condition, therefore the effect is not seen anymore. But you can't empirically see it. You've got to understand the system as an endogenous whole. All right, so defining political economy, now I'll define innovation. I'll define innovation as the application of knowledge by enterprises in a new form, to increase the techniques, products commercially available in a region or economy. I'm not looking at something new in a firm. That's an area a lot of business management people talk about. I see only new to the firm as imitation, as copying something that's already been innovated. And that's important. That diffusion of innovation is also important. And the more it gets diffused, the more it becomes standard. Early on, fairly early on in the diffusion process, imitation is still quite innovative, but as it diffuses, it becomes more standard. And you can see that with various Twitter and all the other technologies. So innovation is both technological and organizational. In other words, it's not just the laptop or the spinning wheel whatever technologies you come up with. It's also the human resources necessary to be able to understand how to use it, the networks, the learning that is necessary to make it work very efficiently. And that requires cooperative. So interesting that often they talk about technology as being competitive, but yet you need the organizational cooperative mode to actually make it work. So there's a tension in innovation where you need the competition, but you also need the cooperation to make it work properly. The forms of innovation, well, there's a whole order of them, and we've just been recently talking about Chris Freeman. Chris Freeman with his wife, Perez, Carlota Perez, wrote this seminal paper back in 1988, the first ones who actually linked Keynes and Keynesian notions to evolutionary. And they identified four forms of innovation that dovetail. You can start with continuous incremental, which is Kaizen, which the Japanese did, which is tweak the American system and make it work better. You can have radical discontinuous, which can be a new software like Google, which changes the way search engines and so on, which was a lot better than Yahoo. You can have technology systems change, which is a whole cluster of innovations. And you can talk about a whole cluster around a particular type of technology system, whether it's around Microsoft. And so the Microsoft system has then bred a whole lot of cluster of a whole lot of other applications and software and everything that clusters around that. And then finally, you have technological economic paradigm shifts, where like the steam engine and the ICT technology ushers in a whole new structure of structural change, a new path of development, which moves us from a previous mode. So, and they all dovetail. It's not quite clear where they are. I'm interested in the dynamics. Therefore, I'm interested in the traverse, which is tracing out the structural change that occurs through innovation moving from the current path to a new path. And I'm interested in the shift and how innovation brings about this structural change and therefore this shift. It can be done, and it is done, through some policy planning structure. And it's involved usually with private and public mixed in various forms in various ways. But you don't see the traverse except looking back. And a lot of evolutionary economists have looked at the long term and have tried to see it, and looking back and historically trying to see these traverses and so on. Angus Madison, who also recently died, looks at phases of industrialization and classifies them in that sort of way to show different paths. And others talk about long waves, whatever. What I'm coming from a Kaletskian perspective, I was unhappy with living in the long term, because Jan knows, as a Kaletskian, you live in the short term because investment decisions are made in the short term. And businesses have got to make their decisions in the short term. They're not looking at these long traverses. So I'm interested in the sequence of short-term irreversible events that lead to these traverses. And therefore the observed traverse is the empirical observations that begin my inquiry as to where that traverse could go. And the traverse could go in various ways. And I use the word transformative when those innovations can spur significant new general purpose technologies that shift you to another path. That happened with ICT technology, which shift us from the old forms of communication to a modern. That happened with the steam engine. That happened with energy and oil, shifting us to transform the way in which we operate. However, there is something that I've called evasive innovation. Since being at an innovation centre in Maastricht, they call it technological fix innovation. It can be quite radical, right? It could be, but it's in that technological fix. It evades the shift. Now, the best examples I know is carbon capture electricity, right? You still produce power, electricity power, through coal stations. And we're very interested in Australia because we've got so much coal that we can drown everybody into in carbon emissions for the next 100 years alone. And we're doing it very well with China, by the way. And what are they interested in Australia? We're per head the highest carbon emitting country in the world by far, on a per capita basis. Luckily, we're only 20 million, so we can't do that much damage. Now, what they're doing in Australia, and what enormous amount of research and development is going in, is to take that CO2 that's coming out, gobble it, put it into a pot, shove it under the earth somewhere, and hope to pray that if you keep putting it, nothing will happen. But the idea is to put it back in. Now, that is radical innovation. But it's evasive. It evades the problem. Hybrid cars is another example. You know, by electricity, electric cars, so you shove the power, and where does the power come from? Wherever the power grid decides. And that's evading the issue about what you are doing. So you're stuck in a technological fix. All right, investment. Investment can be tangible, capital accumulation. It can be intangible, which is what I mentioned before, codified, tacit knowledge, the sort of things that are necessary to operate tangible investment. But there's also public investment, from universities to internet access to technology parks to incubators to protection of patents. All of this is investment by the public sector to support innovation. And total investment is really adding up all that together. And Schumpeter gave it the term juggler from the first person who looked at investment cycles. And there is studies done about the instability of investment. What's interesting is that in the long boom that we had from about 1993, driven by ICT technology and all of that, what's interesting is since about 2004, the effectiveness of the investment has fallen, which means that the amount of investment dollars for every bang, for every dollar of investment for that you put in, you need less investment dollars to get more GDP because you're already into a system. The system is well and truly entrenched. So you don't need a lot more dollars. That means that there were a lot of dollars available globally to be used for other things rather than real innovation because they weren't doing it. It was just incremental. And what it ended up being was financial innovation. So it opened the door for financial innovation. Now, this gives you some idea, and I won't go... This is the proportion of investment in world GDP. So this is a figure which measures the gross capital formation, how total capital investment as a proportion of GDP. And you can see the first long boom in the during the post-war period, and the other one coming here through ICT with a couple of drops in innovation because of the business cycle process. This one is the one I talked about, which is the effectiveness. That is bang for your buck. For how many GDP dollars do you get for every $1 of investment? And notice that in 2004 it started to fall. In other words, look at that. The amount of investment that was actually being invested for every dollar of GDP was falling. Where was that money going? they didn't have to innovate anymore. They were just doing minor incremental. It all was going into financial innovation. And there's a whole lot of a story of other researchers. These are the sort of cycles that you end up looking at in turn. But I won't go through it because I've got time. We know about Michael Kaletsky. He works on a Marx Keynes Kaletsky model. He was the one talking about political economy of full employment. The innovation context for me is the profit levels that are generated from investment, and the profits are generated because of investing in capital goods. But the question is, what sort of capital goods are you investing in? And what sort of innovation knowledge are you enhancing in that process? Investment decisions are made in the short term. So here we've got interesting dynamic. Innovation is, the evolutionists look at it in the long term, but I know that that innovation should be studied in the short term because it's represented by investment decisions done in the short term. So what we've got is basically investment, i.e. is a function of animal spirits and the degree of confidence. In other words, investment, if and what happened after 2004 was that there were the degree of confidence was strong about ICT. Any, you know, you could build another app, another thing, and there was a lot of investment in incremental innovation because it reduced the uncertainty. So when you break it down, what investment is, it's a function of profits, which enables, it's an inducement. Profits is the ability to invest. Change in profits is the expectations of what you're going to get in the future. That is the inducement. Gearing ratio, that is the increasing risk, the problem of the more you invest, the more chance you might have of picking the wrong horse and going bust. And capital utilization is the effective demand. It gives you an indication of how much demand there is for product production. And you see, this is assuming no technological progress in this very simple model. And so what we've got is a way of seeing it in terms of, if you want to see it as a pie, what's happening is that capitalists want to increase their profits. There's an income struggle. In periods of boom, the profits increase. Workers get less, but there's a problem. As workers get less, the effective demand starts to fall. So you've got a, in a given pie, you've got a problem, a dilemma in the capitalist economy. What resolves that dilemma is innovation. And Kaletsky saw a static position where that dilemma is not resolved. But through embedding capital accumulation through innovation, you generate a larger pie. People want more apps and more, and therefore demand increases. And you can give workers a bit more because it allows the pie to increase and the profits can be increased. Without innovation, you maintain that dilemma. So Kaletsky calls innovation the most significant development effect that allows the system to move on to that sort of long term. All right, so I'm not going to go through this in detail. These are just the endogenous variables of the theory of investment, which is basically the ones I've already mentioned. But there are institutional elements that are in the background which determine how those particular endogenous variables will work out in different countries and different regions. Competition between firms, role of agents in the firm. For instance, in some countries, all you've got is necessity entrepreneurs who are forced to, because the choice is unemployment or be a fruit seller, then they be a fruit seller. Fruit seller committed suicide, then you get the whole of North Africa going up in flames. And that is part of the institutional element of that. Other role of agents in firms can be in societies where there's a great deal of opportunity. And so there's opportunity entrepreneurship. which brings a whole different context to the amount of investment that's going, because necessity investment, there's not much in a fruit seller's investment of a fruit wagon or petrol to burn himself up or whatever. Financial behaviour of firms is important, the role of innovation in these particular ones and the role of the state in encouraging it. And so all that fits into the investment story. From a Kaletskian perspective, the cause of investment is the essential dynamic which drives the business cycle. The three elements of that dynamic, there's the time lag, the time decision, and that could be quite long. Baduri talked about the problem that if it's very long, then there's going to be structural change problems because people are losing their jobs in the old industries, but if the new one taking a long time, there's going to be a long time of structural unemployment, a lot of problems in there. So time lags do matter. Feedback loops, how quick you can get your returns on profit on those innovations. That's why you do incremental. Quick returns on profit back into the investment. And that encourages you to do a lot of incremental. Instability, exposure to risk. Therefore, bigger the risk, the more fundamental uncertainty, the more is concerned about your investment. Innovation presents systems from settling. So, you know, Kaletsky saw static, but then saw innovations as engendering a trend above that static. It's got to be above the level of depreciation. Now, if you have, we don't have a board, but if you have economies which have large amplitudes going up, that's going to pull the trend up. If you have economies where there's only incremental innovation and therefore investment is not per buck is less, then there's less investment going up and the trend falls. So the shape of the trend is where the cycle is. Cycles drive the trend. That's why I don't have any qualms that say I don't want to study the trends, because trends are just an outcome of what the cycles are doing. And that's where the decisions come. The cycles come from two elements of innovation. It could be process innovation through increased productivity, or a new level of demand because new products. So everybody wants to buy the iPad or the iPod or the iPhone or the II. Or now we're getting off I because there's a challenge from Google and this area and all that sort of stuff. Now, I've been spending the last... I was at an innovation centre in the Netherlands who they do a lot of work on innovation, and they're evolutionary, and they come from a Schumpeterian world, and I love to go to them because they imbued my Kaletskian with their knowledge. I don't work in their focus, but I understand better innovation from groups because Keynes, Kaletsky, all the nobody, very little I've written in my little entry piece for John King's, which is on there about the lack of study on innovation from the perspective of post-Keynesian. But so I go to where I can be inspired by the work that has been inspired from Schumpeter, for instance, at the level of technology, knowledge accumulation. Richard Nelson, who I only just saw just a few weeks ago, gave a lecture about path dependency trajectories, all these long-term things about the way in which structures change, which is great stuff. There's this vast research, but it seems to me it's all at the meso level. In other words, not micro, it's not macro, it's that sort of industry level stuff. I want to go to the macro level and link it into the business cycles and all that sort of stuff through critical realism. I won't go through that. Basically, there's a lot of similarities between evolution and Kaletsky and the top ones, and even the other ones you can see linkages that are very useful. This is my little framework that I use. I use the National Innovation System, which is an evolutionary concept, which is also comes even right back to Francis Bacon, which is basically how innovation is done through the universities, through their links to businesses, through training, through all the... And that's where the public sector is, all on that outline border that sets the context. Now, we could start anywhere in my circular flow. By the way, I've taught a political economy course where there is no static diagram ever. Everything is taught by circular flows. You can have circular flows of international trade, circular flows of innovation, circular flows of income. And it's great because you can teach dynamics straight away. So what I'll start here with the delta change I've used for innovation. So assuming innovation has occurred, then you need to commercialize it in the form of investment. Investment creates spending, which creates aggregate demand, which leads to GDP, which we saw in the earlier graphs. The GDP, hey, happily gives us profits. The profits enables further investment. You've got this cycle that a lot of post-Keynesians talk about. But I've added this one. This profits also allows investment in R&D, not R&D. R&D is broader. It's R&D, but it's also the intellectual, the training. I'm doing a study on firms and how they build human capital capacity in their firms and the amount of investment they're doing. Once a human resource person only handed out paychecks, but now human resource people have got to understand these sort of stuff, and it's quite interesting how many do and don't. But that R&D is built up from all this profit. Now, some of this R&D works and results in profits, works and results in new innovations. A lot of it doesn't. But none of it is lost. All of it feeds into the national. Every failure is a success, I teach my students in innovation, because every failure is one step to success. So all the failures feed in to the national innovation system. And so innovation comes not just directly from that, but through the public sector picking up all the failures and all the learning and all of it goes through the universities and gets fed into here and we go around here. All right, so what I'm doing is I'm taking the clustering of Schumpeter. I'm using Rothbard, who reviewed before he flew over to Maastricht and got shot as a Jew who wanted to go back and kill the Nazis, and unfortunately they killed him. Great economist, actually, if you want to look at him. He talked about the need to have an adaptive mechanism to understand Schumpeter. And he said specifically you need Kaletsky. Provides the mechanism through profit link to adapt the cluster of innovation. And I've done some studies about the clustering of innovation leading to the bunching of investment, and therefore you get this. So you can do this over historical time. Now, so we've got the supply side from Schumpeter, we've got the demand side from Kaletsky, and the speed at which innovation happens, the speed and strength, is how quickly the innovation gets diffused. And that depends on the ability of the firms to reinvest their profits from that. But there's a lot of uncertainty, and that uncertainty creates a real problem. And I'll tell you about it. There's, being aware of time, I'll say that the problem starts with this contradictory where the investment depends on profits, but also the change in what you expect. Now, the trouble with incremental is your expectations for change of profits is very little. So the contradictory pull is not strong, and therefore you're not going to get a great deal of encouragement to take risks. And because it is an uncertain world, they won't do it. So there is a tendency to without government support, to actually pull your head in and just stick with what you can do, even though you only get little increases in profits. At least that's better than putting all your eggs in what I call susceptibility, the tension. Particularly at an expansion stage, nobody wants to get off the bandwagon and go onto a new bandwagon. There's too much risk involved. Now, there's an opportunity when the economy is in a contraction for this to happen because it allows new, and it's happened. The Chinese are now, since the growth, the GFC, they've got into markets through their technologies. Because they virtually, with the government stimulus, massive, $250 billion, they really had a little blip. And they were able to support their innovation system and really build. And now all of that is paying off dividends while the rest of us, the Western world, are saying, oh, how are we going to get out of this recession? But the problem with the West is that the monopoly control of innovation systems has led to conservative entrepreneurs and much of it being evasive innovation. So why is it evasive? Because of what I call the political aspects of innovation. They're just like governments had the capacity to have full employment, but capitalists ensured that full employment would never happen because it was against their interests. Governments have the capacity to develop innovation policies that will bring about strategic changes. But there is the monopoly control within the capitalist ranks that will, the fear of the government taking over and controlling that innovation system to the point that they lose their impetus as the controllers of the capitalist economy. So there is the same idea that I'm trying to get across. What happens is that capitalists encourage public policy which supports them through, for instance, protection, IP protection and so on. The best example I know is a little anecdote, but in June of 2004, Sonny Bono put in an amendment to increase the copyright protection from 45 years, as if you need 45 years, to 95 years. 1 month before That's All Right Now, Mama, the first rock and roll record that made it big by Elvis Presley, was actually published and printed and sold 50 years earlier. This enabled the Elvis Presley enterprises to be able to control the Elvis Presley copyright for another 45 years. That is protecting the old innovation. Elvis was really innovative in 1954. He's not terribly innovative, dead. Not terribly innovative in 2004. Why does he need another 45 years protection? This is the innovative system. There is the fear that they want, and that leads to evasive innovation. So what are the fears? First is the loss of economic control. The current incumbents are fearing the new entrants, and that's what's happening now. In Europe, they're fearing the Chinese entrants, and that they certainly don't want further competition from new entrants in their own country. So they want to protect the incumbents through IPRs, through those copyrights and all that. The other thing is policy control. The last thing you want is a government setting an agenda for policy like is happening. Yeah, I've got 5 minutes, is that right?
Sure.
Right. Policy that sets the agenda, not by the capitalists, but by this nasty thing called government. And so we go to a neoliberal policy agenda on innovation. Privatisation, public-private partnerships, public contracting, all of this ensures that the public doesn't do the sort of things that will drive the innovation system away from their control. And finally, it allows innovation also reduces the flexibility because a whole new industrial relations, particularly if you're going to have strong innovation, you're going to have full employment, you're going to have, they still need the flexibility with technological change to cut labour costs and can do it much easier with standard evasive innovation than the new ones. So again, because you don't have to build new skills into the labour force. So all that leads to a cycle which identifies government policy as being evasive. And so at the top of the expansion, you're going to be evasive. Well, what about the bottom? The opportunity at the bottom is for innovation. But the publicly stimulatory package has got to go against the trend. And you think, oh, well, yes, all the old capitalists are going to die out of the contractionary phase, and we're going to get the creative destruction that's going to come with Schumpeter. No! What does the government do? Bail out General Motors, the greatest dinosaur. If you ever see Who Killed the Electric Car in 1984, it was the General Motors. Right? Now, to me, the bailout is an example of how you're stopping creative destruction in the capitalist economy. Governments need to understand that process. And therefore, we've got a system which is aimed to support private accumulation of the ones in power. And therefore, they're looking at rent-seeking behaviour and constraining transformative innovation. Now, what's this rent-seeking behaviour? This is what we've got, folks. That's the dirty pollution technology. This is the peak oil problem. This is the carbon emissions problem and the CO2 emissions that we've got. What we need is sustainable development. Brundtland said that back in 1987. Vasselli talks about it in terms of creating innovations for future generations that allow a whole set of options which our future generations can use. We can't cut off options. We've got to allow for sustainable developments to occur in the future. This requires a strong sustainability definition and requires us to protect all this, the disappearing ice, the poor old polar bear. So what's happening? These are the examples of evasive innovation. So collapse of the Copenhagen summit was an example of inability to agree on implementing something that we need. In other words, price something that we're dirty, the free good. Another example is currently my student is doing barriers to Australian stationary renewable energy. The problem that in Australia, every possible barrier is stopped for renewable energy, where naturally you'd think renewable energy would be great. But we have coal, and everything has been done there to stop that. So we're continually into carbon capture and all this. And I'm looking at the dairy industry. And Fonterra is preventing the transformation of really effective new innovations to stop cows from burping. And there is. There's really good innovations to stop cows. But that's not being allowed by Fonterra because that'll cost them money. And totally different systems from the ones that... And Fonterra is just virtually controls the dairy world. So, what do we need? A sustainable framework we need agreed ecological sustainable rules. We've got to have a precaution. We've got to agree that we're stuffing up the planet. Second, we've got to have a perspective plan that allows us to voluntarily conform in a regional basis to ecological goals. Then we've got to create the effective demand through local demand, through niche markets to support this. And finally, the investment will follow to finance and underpin this whole process. The problem is that is difficult to do because investment planning requires an underpinning of infrastructure. It requires us to save on our resources. We need to look at iterative planning of bottom up, not from the top. That's the problem with the Chinese one, but at least the Chinese can tell you that top up, they can do a very good job of it. So I've talked about Adolf Lowe, who we've got to set up an economia vision. In Greek, economia means managing the household, which means both ecology and economy together. You've got to elicit a public motivation towards this. It can happen. Recycling is a good example of public motivation that worked. There are many other examples of public motivation that works, but we've got to do it on a grand scale. Working backwards from what's the 350 parts per millimetre we need in 20 years' time and work backwards. Not work some sort of, but Adolf Lowe says work backwards, set your target, and then use a perspective plan like Kaletsky talks about to work around that string to get to where we want to go for a sustainable path. And that's what I mean by a perspective plan, which is bounded rationality, procedural system, a goal of sustainable. Now, I'll end with very quickly a parable, Atlantis. this ends with friends. We don't know exactly where Atlantis was, but you know what happened to Atlantis? It was a beautiful natural environment. Beautiful. That's a drawing, a painting, supposedly. But greed and corruption came into Atlantis. Really ugly. And so God punished them. In one night, just disappeared. What Francis Bacon said is we need a new Atlantis. One which is, where is this? Somebody will have to tell us afterwards. Ben Solomon was another island, a created fable, where science and technology works together with nature to create a sustainable environment for the future. This was done in 1620. And we are now, right? How many years later? We can't achieve it. What we need is the sixth wave. A new book's coming out. We've had five waves of technology. We need a sixth wave. But all five waves have been done through a process by which the government sort of helped and supported it, but sort of ad hoc. If we wait ad hoc, new technology, a shift to a new path, it's going to take us 50 years. We haven't got 50 years. We are going to be dead. My children's children will not be here to inherit. We have no time to wait for the capital system to bring about the change in 50 years. We need to bring about in 20 years. And we can only do it by a low Kolesky investment innovation planning framework. Thank you.
Jan, could I invite you to give us your thoughts?
Okay. I did have the privilege of being able to see the overhead slides and the background papers, and I've really focused my remarks. I've got really around 6 points. The first one is to complement Jerry on a brisk very scholarly paper with extensive reading. What he's in effect done is he's reorganised the wide canvas of post-Keynesian analysis around the theme of innovation and sustainable development. In a sense, I'll step slightly out of this and make my remarks will be rather more historical. I mean, this, particularly on where some of these ideas come from, not because I'm necessarily interested in the history, not necessarily because the history of economic ideas has value, but because really for two reasons. One, I think is it's important to know where economics went wrong, and you know we have to. Particularly for those of us that believe that economics has gone wrong. But also the other reason is to see how some of these old ideas keep recurring in economics. And as an old artist friend of mine used to say, like the burps after a good meal.
That's twice we've used the burping, haven't we?
All right. Okay, so let me first of all, and along the way, I'll make some perhaps some critical remarks. First of all, let me just say that it doesn't seem to me that post-Keynesian economics is an obvious place to start in a political economy of innovation or sustainable development. And when I say post-Keynesian economics, I'm actually not including Kolesky in post-Keynesian economics. Maybe this reflects my own arguments I've been having recently with certain American post-Keynesians who definitely wouldn't accept Kolesky amongst the post-Keynesians. And I think for a very specific reason, I think post-Keynesian economics is not an obvious place to start in this kind of political economy of innovation or sustainable development. And that is because if you take out Kolesky's stand and so on, essentially post-Keynesian economics has no theory of the firm. I know Fred Leawood would go ballistic at this point. But
so would what's his name?
A number of, but and this is why I think you move to the obvious people, the correct people, namely Kaletsky, Steindl, and Schumpeter, not all of whose views are necessarily compatible with Keynesian or post-Keynesian ideas, and Schumpeter in particular, who, you know, certainly some of his macroeconomics may be compatible with Keynes, but let's remember Schumpeter in the 1930s was a liquidationist. I mean, he really, really believed that you let market forces have their way, and eventually the economy will recover spontaneously from depression. And he was definitely hostile to the New Deal and some of the industrial economics that that came along with the New Deal, or industrial policy that came along with the New Deal. Innovation in Schumpeter is really a concern. It's very, very specific, and this is the development of new combinations in production. New combinations of factors of production, either to produce new goods or to produce existing goods. And precisely because there were new combinations, there is this link with uncertainty. But it's also because the outcome of this is uncertain. It raises a link going back with Adam Smith to Adam Smith's views on this kind of innovation and the resulting uncertainty. Adam Smith was very, very clear. He liked established businesses operating in a routine fashion for the simple reason that it was in those businesses that competitive forces could work themselves out and could bring down the rate of profit. It's not that he was not keen on entrepreneurs. He believed that entrepreneurs should find out, or in other words, what we would call innovators, should finance their own activities out of their own pocket. And he had a very, very specific reason for believing this. He didn't believe that they should be aided either by the state or by the or by financial institutions, for a very, very, very specific and very, very Adam Smith type of reason. Adam Smith, whose first book was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, believed that the characteristic feature of entrepreneurs is that they tend to have an exaggerated view of their prospects of success, and this is due to vanity. Okay. And that's what his views contrasted with, for example, those of John Ray, not a contemporary, but it was rather later than Adam Smith. John Ray, who argued that you needed the state actually to undertake the innovations because the state could then take the losses and could provide the certainty for businesses engaged in this kind of, in developing new industry or innovating. The view Bentham is also worth mentioning here, because Bentham also had very different views. Bentham thought that entrepreneurs should be financed by the state, but that was because he had developed his own his panopticon, his prison, which he thought his new design for a prison, which he wanted financed. So that, I think there is this link going back to Adam Smith, and the issues that were raised in those debates come up again in as the political economy of innovation that you mentioned. Let me move on to Kaletsky and the problem with innovation in Kaletsky. Kaletsky divided up innovation into embodied and disembodied innovation. Embodied being innovation that is embodied in a machine, and disembodied being, for example, new ways of organizing a workforce that would make it more productive. But essentially, in his analysis, innovation is passive. It really depends on rates of investment. So if you have a country like China, which is devoting over 40% of its GDP to investment, by definition, the equipment that they're installing will be relatively new, so their technology will be very new. You'll get new technology. If you have countries like, say, the UK and the US, who invest a much lower, a smaller proportion of their GDP, there'll be a tendency for the equipment, for industrial equipment, to be much older and backwards. So there's this element. There's this relationship with the rate of investment. Now, China seems to me is a very interesting example, is a very interesting case in point of whether it's possible, by devoting a very, very high proportion of your GDP to investment, whether you can be particularly innovative. Now, in China, as it happens, a huge amount of the investment is infrastructure. Yes, there are new industries being established, but there's certainly catch-up investment or catch-up innovation. It's innovation in relation to the infrastructure and the industrial equipment that China had before. But is it bringing China up to the forefront of technology? And, you know, one has one's doubts about this. Albeit the Chinese are now trying to make up by, you know, investing in satellite technology and so on. It's not clear to me. Kaletsky's view, and the early Steindl before the 1970s, really emerged out of their own experience, documented in Kaletsky's work and in Steindl's Maturity, the first edition of Maturity and Stagnation in American Capitalism. The 1890, where Steindl looked specifically at American capitalism from the 1890s and the 1930s, and what you find is, yes, stagnation. There is innovation. Three fundamental new technologies which emerge: electronics, the internal combustion engine, and what was the third one? Chemicals. Chemicals industry or pharmaceuticals, none of which actually take off on a major scale. And this is where you know, clearly for Steindl and Kaletsky, this is the link with the monopoly capitalism, that industry is operating at less than full capacity. They won't invest. There's a reluctance to invest. Steindl then changes his mind in the 1970s, and this appears in his introduction to the second edition of Maturity and Stagnation. Around 1976, Steindl had looked at the work of Chris Freeman and starts reflecting on the possibility that actually, if you do have new technologies, you may encourage firms actually to do more investment than they would do, or replace old equipment, start replacing old equipment, so that irrespective of all those stagnationist features, you could get an investment boom. Okay, this is the change of mind of stagnation. If we link this kind of technological innovation, technological leadership, and so on, you don't find this appearing in Keynesian economics, certainly not in Keynes's economics. The investment function, the marginal efficiency of capital, does include innovation, because innovation may give rise to a change in expectation or improved expectation of future returns. But then what happens is that innovation becomes the pretext for speculation, and in that you think you can make profits, you start trying to find the finance for it, and you go back to this whole discussion that Adam Smith set off on, you know, should the state or should fiduciary financial institutions, should banks with public deposits support this kind of speculation, or should entrepreneurs be left responsibly to finance it out of their own pockets? A discussion which, incidentally, Keynes does refer to in does enter into in the general theory in his remarks on Bentham, and this, of course, then leads me on to the part of your paper which I guess, from, you know, most interests me, and your reference to the work of Carlota Perez. Carlota Perez put forward in a couple of books this idea that technological innovations are associated with financial bubbles, and they need financial bubbles in order to clear out the sort of the speculative elements, and so as to make industrialists more realistic about the financial prospects, or the prospects for particular innovations. You know, after a bubble has been, you can start. There's been a certain amount of experience. You can see the problems with innovative techniques, and then you can implement them more effectively. Again, it seems to me that there are problems with this. I mean, in particular the link with she sees the dot-com bubble as being a particular case in point, of speculative financing. Well, actually, the dot-com bubble, this was on the margins, really, of what was happening in finance. The great financial crisis that you refer to was really an asset boom. It wasn't a new technology bubble. Microsoft hasn't collapsed. I see problems in that. With ICT investment, the figures that you put up, there always were particular difficulties in valuing it. I seem to remember a discussion with, I think Wynne Godley was involved in some of this back in the 1990s. I remember having a discussion with him. The problem with innovations is that when innovations come out, when new products come out, they cost a lot. And then as other firms innovate and the market becomes more competitive, their price falls. You can see this with ICT, with compact disc technology and so on, digital technology. It's all become very much cheaper. it then becomes a problem as to how you value it for gross national product purposes. Because if you want to value it in relation to real GDP, the standard way in which this is valued is by you have the investment in a particular year, and then the value of that that investment is then uprated by the GDP deflator. Or you take investment in a particular year and you deflate it by the GDP deflator. This actually tends to exaggerate the value of ICT investment, because the actual value of innovative investment is that in money terms is falling because of its increase in cheapness. This may be offset by actually more buying of the equipment. So there are these valuational problems which make me really go back to make me rather suspicious of the whole notion that America is in any way at the forefront of new technology, because of this whole financial apparatus of venture capital and so on, which supposedly supports new technology. If you take ICT, for example, the US has a deficit in its trade, its foreign trade, in information technology products. And if you look at it more carefully, you find that it's actually the software that's being innovated. Why is the software the big American innovation? Well, it's the bigger American innovation because it doesn't take much money to innovate in software. You want me to finish? Yes, so I'll conclude by saying that there are, I think the discussion of the political economy of innovation, I think, was wide ranging and scholarly. I like very much its roots, obviously, in Kalecki, Steindl, and Schumpeter. Mm-hmm. And for that reason, I'm very, very pleased to have had this opportunity to give additional remarks on this. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you very much.